Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the recent riots and unrest in the country were orchestrated by the US, the Zionist regime of Israel, and their paid agents. Israeli forces killed two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank following an alleged attempt to conduct a ramming attack against regime forces. Also in the headlines, the International Energy Agency calls on Europe to lower gas consumption during the winter amid fears of a total cutoff of Russian supplies. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, top story this hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the recent riots in the country were plotted by the United States, Israel, and their paid agents. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the comment in an address to military cadets in Tehran. The leader said he was saddened by the death of a young woman which triggered the riots, but he said the reactions to the incident, including insecurity on the streets and the burning of the Holy Quran and mosques, were not normal. Ayatollah Khamenei said the death of the young woman was a pretext for some foreign governments to foment insecurity and rioting. The leader added that such governments cannot tolerate Iran's progress and power. Ayatollah Khamenei described those governments as bullies, saying they are taking aim at Iran's independence, resistance, and power. UK-based political analyst Masood Shejara says the tragic death of Mahsa Amini has been used as a pretext by Iran's adversaries to instigate rioting in Iran.
It is a very sad affair of loss of the life of a young woman, but this is not the issue. This has been an excuse for rioting, killing people, burning security officers, and burning buildings, etc., etc. And you know, it's very clear for a very long time. Opponents of Iran, the regime in occupied Palestine, United States and Saudis and have been saying very clearly that they are set to create disharmony. They are there to actually create havoc within Iran and create this type of thing. And even when we hear the maximum pressure is a catalyst for creating the environment when this sort of thing could take place. This is really trying to create a sort of havoc that was indeed implemented in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere. This is actually trying to destroy the whole infrastructure and bring such insecurity which will affect every Iranian, be it their supporter or opponent of any issue whatsoever.
And Iran has urged European countries to fulfill their international obligations and provide full security to its diplomatic missions. That's after violent protests hit several Iranian embassies in European capitals. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the attacks were carried out by violent people affiliated with anti-Iran groups. Kanani was referring to a number of gatherings outside Iranian missions over the death of Mahsa Amini. The protests turned violent in London and Oslo, where several people were arrested by the local police. Kanani says the attackers managed to damage the outer sections of Iranian diplomatic missions as host countries failed to properly protect them. The Palestinian Prime Minister has urged the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its atrocities almost on a daily basis across the occupied territories. Speaking at the weekly cabinet meeting, Mohammed Shataya also called for an immediate end to the regime's bloody escalation and serious violations of the Palestinians' rights. Meantime, people in the Jalazun refugee camp in the north of Ramallah have staged the protests against the Israeli killing of two Palestinians in an overnight attack. The two men were shot dead in connection with what the regime claims was an attempted car ramming attack on its forces in the West Bank. The reports say the incident took place while Israeli troops were carrying out a raid on a Palestinian refugee camp in the area. The European Union always condemns Israel when it comes to its violations in the occupied Palestinian territories, including the regime's illegal settlement activities or abuse of Palestinians. But in practice, the EU's support for Israel remains ironclad. The EU's disregard for human rights and democracy has become even more blatant in recent years, which shows how its words of condemnations do not represent its actual notion of human rights.
When it comes to the relationship between the EU and Israel, one thing is evident. The EU comes out defending Palestinians and condemns Israel for its different violations, from settlements to the killing of Palestinians. But words of condemnations are just that, words. For when it comes to doing anything about it, it does absolutely nothing. There is a broad consensus that the EU is not an honest broker when it comes to Israel and Palestine, and that the very DNA of the Israel-EU relationship reveals that on Palestinian rights, Brussels only condemns Israeli illegal acts. Be it in response to the unfounded allegations in the 2021 dossier, which offered no proof to justify the terror label for Palestinian groups, or to the all-frequent military onslaught on Gaza. The EU has done little to hold Israel accountable besides ritual but ineffectual expressions of concern. In fact, the EU recently reiterated its commitment to developing closer diplomatic ties and agreed to resume meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council. Another sign of Europe's somewhat covert support for Israel is a memorandum of understanding between the EU, Egypt, and Israel, where Cairo is set to export Israeli gas to Europe. All this has also shed light on the West's double standards regarding the Palestine-Israel conflict, and this has only been further clarified through the West's support of Ukraine in light of the Russian special military operation there. The world rallied behind Ukraine and left Palestinians frustrated, who witnessed being criminalized and were constantly being told that they don't have the right to resist, or even labeled as terrorists or anti-Semites just for asking for their rights. Despite the long list of horrific human rights violations in Palestine and other atrocities in the world, the West is yet to display a unified response to the Israeli aggressions. But what makes matters worse is the West claims it supports human rights, like for Palestinians, yet it continues to do nothing when it comes to the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights.
Turning to Russia now, where members of the lower house of parliament approved legislation to annex 4 Ukrainian regions into the country. The State Duma voted to incorporate Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia with no abstentions or votes against the ratification. Russia's upper house, the Federation Council, is expected to formalize the annexation on Tuesday. Last Friday, President Vladimir Putin signed a decree for the formal accession of the territories to Russia. Moscow says people in the 4 regions have voted overwhelmingly to join the Russian Federation in referendums held last week, but Ukraine and its Western allies have called the votes illegal and a sham. It's time now for our news review segment. The International Energy Agency says Europe must reduce gas consumption ahead of winter to survive the impact of Russia's halt to its natural gas flow to the continent. The agency says Russia's reduced flows to Europe deepen market tensions as global gas demands are expected to fall by 0.8% this year. The IEA says it also disrupts trade flow, leading to fuel shortages in some emerging and developing economies ahead of the winter. The IEA has also anticipated that markets will remain tight well into 2023. Russia supplied about 40% of European gas consumption before the Ukraine war. Russian gas flows are still running, but at severely reduced rates, pushing prices to record levels. Moscow says Western sanctions have hindered gas exports. European politicians say that's just a pretext and Russia is using energy as a weapon. Joining us for more on that is Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels, and also John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Gentlemen, welcome. Jerome, if I could start with you. So the fear is Russia shutting off the taps completely. Is there any indication from Brussels about lifting some of the sanctions on the Russian energy sector to allow Europeans to heat their homes?
Well, the reality is that the European Union is looking at every other place that it can in terms of trying to get in energy to try and to eliminate the need to bring in energy from Russia after decades of us getting cheap gas from Russia directly piped into the European Union. And, you know, what people, more and more ordinary people, are asking right now is how bad could it actually get? Because we see rising inflation, it's rising by the day, and in response to that, the European Central Bank in the 19-country eurozone is increasing interest rates. So people's home loans, the mortgages are going up every single month. And people are wondering, you know, if we get a very cold winter, how bad could this crisis actually get? Because, of course, we need energy to run the whole economy in terms of transporting goods and food items and so on. Food prices are very, very high. So really, people are worried about how bad things could get, not only from an economic perspective and from an energy perspective, which is what we're talking about now, but also militarily. People are more and more worried that this could escalate further and that we could be heading towards World War III. I mean, really, you know, when we talk about that, it sounds very alarmist, but really that's what people are asking. Are we pushing Russia to the point, is the West pushing Russia to the point where we could have a complete collapse and World War III? And also, more and more people, when we talk about energy bills, when we talk about food prices, when we talk about inflation and interest rates, more and more people are also asking, how did we get here? You know, instead of just talking about the cost of energy, we have to go back. I mean, I've been in Brussels here for almost 10 years, attending all of the NATO meetings, and all of those meetings over the past 10 years have been dominated by the issue of Russia. We need to control Russia. There was never any ruling out of Ukraine joining NATO or joining the European Union. There was this constant provocation towards Russia. And so now more and more people are being educated. And this is where the conversation is switching to, is how did we get here? How did our politicians, our Western leaders, actually manage to get us to a situation where not only are we seeing record inflation, energy prices, food prices, but also the potential for World War III?
Right. What's your take on that, John? Was this a long-term strategy to contain countries that pursue independent political, economic policies such as Russia, such as Iran, such as China?
Absolutely. That's a continuation of the containment policy used against the Soviet Union. Many people expected that when the Soviet Union collapsed and when the people of Russia chose to establish a multi-party democracy and a largely capitalist economy that would be competitive with the West, that it would be a time of peace. In fact, what the West wanted to do was to destroy Russia, break it up into pieces, and colonize it, not to have a new competitor who could take business away from them. So we're seeing the coming to a head of the destructive policies of the West that created a situation in which they're doing exactly what they said they would not do, and that is destroying the non-communist multi-party democracy that has emerged from the former Soviet Union.
And John, is there any hope for European consumers, European families, European pensioners this winter?
Well, there is hope, and that is the basic hope that all of us have about our political leaders, and that is that they will come to their senses. We have a political class that actually does not use brains here in Europe. Most of Europe is a military, political, or economic colony of the United States, and in many cases, it's a colony in all three aspects. When you have a country which has a ruling class, which is remote controlled by puppet strings leading to Washington via London, then what you have is a group of people who do not think for themselves. And this kind of a crisis, in which the people of their own nations are going to assert their own control over their own leadership, this is the kind of crisis that can actually produce a democracy. And that's what I expect to see happen. The people of Europe have a long tradition of political activity at the grassroots level. When they do not have heat in wintertime, when their children are getting ill and sick, and when their elderly are dying in the cold, they are going to rise up against their leaders, and their leaders are then going to have to choose between their own people and their puppet masters in Washington. And generally speaking, when the puppet masters are a long way away, cutting the strings becomes much, much easier to do.
Right. Jerome, is there any acknowledgement at all in Brussels that the US-led sanctions have backfired essentially against the European households who are suffering the most out of all of this?
No, any time that this is raised with Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, or any of the individual leaders across the 27 member states, or the EU foreign policy chief, the immediate answer is no, this is all Russia's fault. So they don't talk, they never talk about sanctions backfiring. And also this issue of replacing energy supplies from Russia. I mean, if you speak to economists, if you speak to energy experts, it's not simply a case of replacing, bringing in huge amounts of liquefied natural gas from the United States and from other areas, from North Africa and from, you know, other parts of Europe. And so on in the Middle East. It's not a case, when you just simply replace the energy, there's huge costs associated with that. So it's not just a case of, oh yes, we've managed to get our energy reserves up to a certain point. It costs a fortune to bring in this energy when we were getting it very cheap in the pipelines from Russia. So actually the knock-on effect keeps going. And we haven't seen anything yet because, of course, we have seen massive energy prices and businesses, small businesses going out of business, even larger businesses going down. And that's set to continue if we see the current trend, because as the demand for energy increases and as the prices keep pushing up, businesses will fold. But also there will be a knock-on effect for the politicians because we haven't seen the major political ramifications yet. Ordinary citizens, they really will get upset with right. Their politicians.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. Let me thank our guests. Jerome Hughes is our correspondent joining us from Brussels, and John Bosnich is a journalist, activist, and political analyst joining us from Belgrade.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Hi, how are you? Fine, thanks. I just got your medicines from a nearby pharmacy. Oh, don't mention it. Love you, bye. Well, it was my grandma. She was checking if I had bought her medicines. What was interesting for me is that most of these medicines have herbal basics. It's great that God has created so many valuable herbs. By the way, tomorrow I'm going to visit Rubar Plain of Shahr Babak in Kerman province. In this eye-catching plain, rhubarb plant is grown. This wonderful plant has lots of medicinal advantages. Stay with me. Shahr Babak is an important city in Kerman, which is located west of this province. In the 20-kilometer distance of Shahr Babak, there is a plain with a beautiful and eye-catching view, which is known as Rhubarb Plain. This plain is considered as one of the touristic districts of Shahr Babak, which shines like a red gem and shows a very beautiful scene of nature. From middle of April, for 2 to 3 weeks, the 2,400-hectare plain is all red with a vast coverage of the plant rhubarb. The leaves of this plant are large and green, while its bunch-like flower is red, which creates a spectacular view. Rhubarb has some elements in itself, such as potassium and calcium, and it is relatively rich in vitamins. The petiole of rhubarb, which is its usable part, has some organic acids, such as malic acid, which is beneficial for quenching thirst and easing the digestion of food. ask the local people if I'm going the right direction. Sorry, sir. How can I get to Rubar Plain of Shahrebabak?
Go straight. You have just 1 kilometer to the plain.
Thank you very much indeed. I've heard that rhubarb is rich in antioxidants, particularly anthocyanins, which give it its red color. These antioxidants have antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, and anti-cancer properties, which help protect you from many health-related issues, such as heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. Wonderful. God, I see a vast red velvet blanket just in front of my eyes. Beautiful, gorgeous, extraordinary. Have you ever tasted this advantageous plant? I have not. Let me try some. Sour and very delicious. And of course, rich in calcium and potassium. I'll get some for my grandma and myself. Rhubarb is a very beneficial plant that is also used in making fruits or desserts. You can also see this plant in the villages and cities around Shahrebabak. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ يُوهُ بِلِيهِ اسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then begin this sermon the way the Commander of the Faithful used to begin his, by advising us, Usikum ibadallah bittaqwallah. that I advise you, O the servants of God, to be God-conscious, God-fearing, and pious human beings. When we look at the fitra of a human being, the innate nature that we've been created with, if you recall a month prior, we talked about the fitra and what the fitra is. You know, the fitra is something that is given to us as a gift by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is something which is naturally found within all human beings. And the responsibility is that we utilize this fitra to find and connect ourselves to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But one of the points we always have to recall and remember is that this fitra is, if we can just put it, it's like a beacon of light that is within each and every one of us, right? But it serves or it remains in a state of potentiality. Yeah? That means it has the potential of either being utilized to illuminate our lives and to illuminate the lives of everything around us, the way light does, or it has a way of becoming extinguished, sullied and rusted because we didn't utilize it correctly. It's in a state of potentiality, just like a youth. Yeah, who has the potential of becoming the best servants of God or transgressing against Allah, is in a state of potential. Likewise, our fitra is in a state of potential. And it depends on how we utilize our fitra, our innate nature, depending on what we expose it to. It can either blossom and shine brighter, illuminating everything, or it can be sullied, as we talked about. And this internal light eventually succumbing to the environments that we live around us. The thing we have to understand about our fitra, and it's important, right, is that even if a human being does not intentionally sin and does not live a life that is vicious, simply not taking the time to nurture the fitra, to blossom the fitra, the world has a way of sullying and dimming the life of the fitra on its own. Right? This is why there is a constant struggle. Right? It's not just the struggle of not sinning. It's the struggle of trying to become better every day and not becoming stagnant and not becoming like a water that is not flowing, because a water that doesn't flow eventually spoils. Right? And so the fitra is very similar. Right? We have to constantly work towards it because the world has a way of numbing it, if we can put it that way. And there are many reasons for this. Right? For example, we are constantly exposed to things that are counter to Islamic values in the world that we live in. Whether we live in an Islamic world or we don't, the world has become small today. There are so many isms, materialism, secularism, that we are exposed to. Things which Islam says are haram, are halal in the environment that we see and we live around us. Munkar is no longer munkar. It's no longer reprehensible. And even though as believers, we don't engage in these things. We don't engage in haram. We don't engage in these munkars. But because we are constantly exposed to them, it has a way of numbing our soul. It has a way of sullying our fitra. You add on to that, that sometimes we have taken our religion more as a custom and a tradition rather than this light that needs to be focused on, rather than it becoming a heartbeat of our existence. I mean, just think about it, right? From the perspective of our salah that we're about to recite, the fact that, you know, we can wake up in the middle of the night asleep, yeah, and pray that salah half asleep and still fulfill all the requirements of the dhikr, it shows that we have become accustomed to it, right? But we have to have that mindset that every time I come for salah, this is not something that's just a checkbox. It has to be something which is reviving me. It's the fuel to my existence. But because, again, we have been doing it for so long, it just has a way of doing that. It has a way of becoming ritualistic. And you add on to that, right? The pursuit of material comforts. Now, again, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. No one says we can't live a comfortable life. But the natural byproduct of us seeking a material enjoyment, even if it be in the most modest of ways, is that it will distract us from the pursuit of spiritual strength. You look at all of these reasons. We don't have to be sinful for our fitra to become extinguished. We don't have to be sinful for our fitra to become rusted. And so what it requires is that we constantly work. We constantly improve. We constantly become better. You just take the example from our history. 50 years after the wafat of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad wa ajil farajhum. The ummah was in such a state that Aba Abdullah alayhi salam had to rise for reformation. 50 years. Yeah, the ummah had already become in that state. Imagine where we are 1400 years later, right? And so we have to reflect on this. And you know, the beauty of God is that He gives us opportunities to awaken to this reality. Yeah? You look at many times where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in the way that God works mysteriously and beautifully, He gives us what is known as opportunities of yaqza, yeah, awakening. You know, yaqza in Islamic akhlaqi literature is the opposite of ghafla. Ghafla is this normal state of unawareness or unattentiveness that a human being goes through in life. The way sometimes we do. We wake up, we have a cup of coffee, we get ready, we get in the car, we go to work, almost robotic, right? We are accomplishing things, alhamdulillah, but how much are we accomplishing for our souls, right? It takes a human being to awaken to realize that, man, I gotta work harder. I have to work better. And this is what's known as yaqza, right? Yaqza comes in different ways. You know, sometimes yaqza or this awakening comes when a human being hits rock bottom, right? Rock bottom is not a state where you want to hit. Yeah, but if you've ever hit rock bottom, you realize, man, there's nowhere to go but up now. Yeah, because this is where I am ashamed of what has happened. And oftentimes these rock bottoms that we're talking about is where I see a very strong material consequence to my action. Like a person who sins will get arrested. Now they're in jail, now they think about their actions, and they're like, man, I have to improve. Or they do something, they say something, they are embarrassed, they realize that, man, now I have to improve. Sometimes we hit rock bottom. That's God's way of telling us, look, this is your chance now. Come back to me. I will take you to me, right? Sometimes rock bottom or sometimes yaqza comes when we are faced with some type of rude awakening, whether it's a death of a loved one, yeah, whether it's a natural disaster that strikes, whether now the doctor tells me, Baba, if you don't do something, you're going to suffer tremendously. I get this awakening, right? And again, that's God's way of showing us that, look, you need to change before it's too late. If we look at yaqdas and opportunities of awakenings, I swear to you, one of the most beautiful examples of awakening is Karbala. Yeah? When we look at Karbala, and if we understood Karbala, and if we ponder over Karbala, we will see that it has a natural way of awakening a human being. We saw that even immediately after the tragedy of Karbala. What happened? The uprising of Medina happened. It took the death of Aba Abdullah, the martyrdom of Aba Abdullah, for the uprising of Medina, the uprising of Mukhtar. It didn't have a long-term effect, but it requires people to continue that movement, right? And so I tell you, and I swear to you, and I believe this, and I ponder over this, that if we attended these gatherings with the right intentions, and if we attended it with the desire of becoming better, it doesn't matter who the speaker was, where the speaker was, Allah will give us an opportunity of awakening. And so it's our responsibility to make sure that we utilize this awakening correctly. And you know, in that light, and in this epilogue that we talked about today, the theme that we're going to continue on is we want to use this awakening to become a better human being. We have to, right? I don't want me, and I'm speaking to myself now, and I'm hoping that, and I'm sure that many of us are alike. I don't want us to go back to the normal lifestyle that we had. Yeah, we weren't bad people. Yeah, we were not bad people. But man, there's room for improvement. There's room to ascend towards Allah. We have to take that.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. Oh,
شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. By interfering in the internal affairs of other countries, the United Kingdom has always sought to create sedition, confusion, and controversy in domestic affairs of other countries. In most cases, the destructive decisions of the colonial regime, such as Britain, for other countries, and also its interventionist policies in the internal affairs of various nations and supporting occupying regimes have caused anger and hatred across the world. This comes after reports showed British Prime Minister Liz Truss was considering relocating Britain's embassy in occupied Palestine to the occupied city of Al-Quds, a controversial decision. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Quds News Agency wrote, Palestinians have expressed outrage over reports that British Prime Minister Liz Truss is considering relocating Britain's embassy, which is currently in Tel Aviv, to the occupied holy city of Al-Quds in a controversial decision that would follow in the footsteps of former US President Donald Trump. Some Palestinians described the move as a new Balfour Declaration and said it proved Britain's bias in favor of the Israeli regime. An unnamed Palestinian Authority official said the Ramallah-based and Fatah-controlled government that exercises partial civil control over West Bank has not received an official statement from the British government regarding relocation of its embassy to the occupied city of Al-Quds. The official warned that such dangerous moves would have a negative impact on the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Mustafa Barghouti, Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative Party, said the British Prime Minister belongs to the pro-Zionist conservatives and is known for volte-face on her stances. Mustafa Barghouti stated that Liz Truss and her friends were trying to win support of the Jewish community in Britain. Meanwhile, the Gaza-based Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement condemned the report about relocation of Britain's embassy to the occupied city of Al-Quds. Hamas spokesperson Abdel Latif Ghannous said the announcement by the British Prime Minister Liz Truss about her intention to move her country's embassy to the city of Al-Quds is a flagrant bias towards the Israeli occupying regime. He warned that the move would not give Israel any legitimacy over 1 inch of Palestinian land. A senior official of a Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, Muhammad Shalah, charged Britain with continuing to display arrogance against Palestinians. Muhammad Shalah said, "We're not surprised by what Britain is doing in the light of the ongoing Arab and Islamic silence." Another Palestinian Islamic Jihad official, Tariq Salmi, warned that the controversial British plan would spark the anger of Arabs and Muslims. The Middle East Eye, a London-based online news website covering events in West Asia and North Africa, explains more about the same issue. Three United Nations experts have strongly criticized British Prime Minister Liz Truss's repeated suggestion of a potential plan to move to relocate the British embassy from Tel Aviv to the occupied city of Al-Quds. The special rapporteurs said relocating the British embassy to Al-Quds would break with international law and United Nations resolutions and reverse decades of British policy. Recently, Prime Minister Liz Truss, on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in New York, told her Israeli counterpart Yair Lapid that she is reviewing the embassy's current location. Both Francesca Albanese, the current United Nations Special Rapporteur, and Michael Link, the most recent former UN Special Rapporteur focused on human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967, along with a third United Nations expert, have condemned Liz Truss's suggestion. In a three-page letter sent to British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly recently, Link, as well as Adi Emsais, who worked for 12 years at the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, voiced their concerns on the potential move. The letter, which was seen and reported by Middle East Eye, read, "We write as friends of the United Kingdom to say there is nothing to review. The British Embassy should stay in Tel Aviv unless and until there is a comprehensive peace agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, with the city of Al-Quds being shared as the capital of two states." The British newspaper The Guardian has more about the same story. Ambassadors from all Arab countries have reportedly written a letter to British Prime Minister Liz Truss urging her not to go ahead with an ill-judged plan to relocate the British embassy from Tel Aviv to the occupied city of Al-Quds. The Arab ambassador said the plan could jeopardize talks on a free trade deal between the United Kingdom and the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, PGCC, due to be completed this year. The report said the letter has the endorsement of all the Arab countries, including those that support normalization deals between the Israeli regime and the four Arab countries. Signatories of the letter included the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, the first two Arab countries that normalized their relations with the Israeli regime in 2020. Liz Truss has announced in a letter to conservative friends of Israel that she would open a review of the location of the British embassy. According to The Guardian, a former British diplomat described Liz Truss as a pound shop Donald Trump, making a reference to a 2018 US decision under Donald Trump to move the American embassy to the occupied city of Al-Quds. He said, "She seems to think she should ape Donald Trump," adding, "If the United Kingdom shifted its embassy, it would have a domino effect among some countries in the European Union, countries such as Hungary, but probably not, and will damage British interests in the Arab world." Hossam Zomlot, Palestinian ambassador to London, said any embassy move would be a blatant violation of international law and Britain's historic responsibilities. Hossam Zomlot said, "It undermines the two-state solution and inflames an already volatile situation in the occupied city of Al-Quds, the rest of the Palestinian occupied territories, and among communities in the United Kingdom and worldwide, it would be a disaster. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the Israeli regime has no rightful claim or sovereignty over the occupied city of Al-Quds, including its old city area and holy sites. In a recent statement, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry said respecting the special status of occupied Al-Quds is an integral part of the universally recognized rights of the Palestinian people. The statement added, the Israeli regime has no authority to engage in diplomatic relations or invite states to open diplomatic offices in any part of the city of Al-Quds.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September, 1974. Outside of these lectures, we have spoken a lot about the meaning of God's forgiveness, Ghufran. So, what does forgiveness mean in this context? Forgiveness means to close the gap, to mend the tear, and to heal the wound. This is Ghufran. How can this be achieved? How can this tear in the soul caused by a sin be mended? By making up for it. When someone drags their soul down from the heights of human ideals and causes it to sink to a lower level, they must do something to make up for this in order for their soul to rise again. Take another example. You get into a car and set off on a journey. Now, if the car breaks down on the way, what will happen to you? You'll be delayed. So how can you make up for this delay once you get it working again? By going a little faster, by denying yourself a little comfort, you can still arrive on time.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you just sit there and say, "Oh no, what a mistake I made. Why didn't I set off sooner? Oh God, please forgive me." This won't be of any use to you. Yes, you made a mistake, but now you should make up for it. Go a little faster so that you reach your destination on time. God doesn't say that when you commit a sin, there is nothing you can do to efface it. He is not vindictive. Surely, I am the all-forgiver. The Quran, Surah 20, verse 82. Those sins you committed, those mistakes you made, all of these can be forgiven if you are willing to make up for them. God does not say, because you made one mistake, no matter how hard you try, no matter what you do, you cannot be forgiven. No, surely I am the all-forgiver. I will forgive, I will heal you, and make you whole again. But for what kind of person? For him who repents, becomes faithful, and acts righteously, and then follows guidance. The Quran, Surah 20, verse 82. God says he will forgive the one who repents. And what is repentance? Tawbah? It means to come back. Your path to perfection was here, but you went that way instead. But you can be forgiven. When? When you come back to the path of perfection and follow the right way again. For him who repents, for him who comes back, who strengthens his faith, and who acts righteously. One who acts.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.